This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Looking to start a side hustle or become your own boss? Do it with Shopify. Whether you're selling succulents or stilettos, Shopify has the industry-leading tools to help you create, control, and grow your own business. So get serious about selling and get Shopify today. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.co.uk/special offer.
Hey there, welcome to Immigrantly. It's Adia Khan, and I'm excited to have all of you with me for today's episode. If you're really into ChatGPT, tech, robots, Black Mirror, or the Terminator movies from back in the day, then this episode should be particularly exciting for you. Today, I'm talking about artificial intelligence, AI. Now, we've been hearing a lot more about AI recently, especially since ChatGPT came into the picture back in 2022. But there are still so many questions unanswered. What actually is AI? How does it work? And should we be a bit more careful with the ways we think about it, especially around feminist ethics in AI? But before we dive into our main topic, which is feminist ethics in AI, I want to share a little behind the scenes tidbit with you. You see, as someone who often turns to ChatGPT for research and insights, I thought, why not tap into its vast knowledge again? So in preparation for today's conversation, I asked ChatGPT to whip up a list of possible feminist ethics issues with AI. And folks, let me tell you, the results were pretty insightful. Here's what ChatGPT churned out. Gender bias lurking within AI algorithms, representation of women in AI development teams, ethical considerations surrounding AI applications in reproductive health, addressing biases in facial recognition technology, the impact of AI on gendered labor dynamics, ensuring inclusivity in AI voice assistance, intersectionality, and the inclusion of marginalized communities in AI ethics discussions. What's fascinating to me is that ChatGPT is more aware of the harm that is AI can cause than us mortals. I wish we were as intentional and aware. Anyways, so to learn a little bit more about AI, its uses, and its unexpected imperfections, I am chatting with Dr. Kerry McInerney. Kerry is a scholar and an AI ethicist who researches AI from the perspective of feminism, race, and the Asian diaspora. She is currently a research associate at the Lever Room Center for the Future of Intelligence and a research fellow at AI Now Institute. Her scholarly writing has appeared in multiple journals, and in 2021, she released her podcast, The Good Robot, which she co-hosts alongside fellow AI scholar, Dr. Eleanor Drage.
Hi, and welcome to the Good Robot Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Kerry McInerney.
And I'm the other host, Eleanor Drage. We're both Christina Gore Research Associates at the University of Cambridge Centre for Gender Studies. And we also work in association with the Lieberholm Centre for the Future of Intelligence, which is Cambridge's AI research centre.
This podcast explores the more nuanced side of AI. Not just the science behind it, but the social and ethical sides of it as well. She's also published a book called The Good Robot, Why Technology Needs Feminism, where she edited a collection of essays from other scholars, feminists, and activists on the many complicated facets of AI. So without further ado, let's get started. welcome to Immigrantly. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Thanks so much for having me on.
I am so excited, Carrie, because I feel like I'm a closeted geek. I've always been fascinated by technology. Don't understand it much, but have always been curious about, you know, developments in technology, what we can achieve. But with AI specifically, I am extremely enamored by it, but I feel threatened and scared at the same time. And a lot of people listening are probably familiar with AI. But just to clarify, what is the actual definition of AI and what forms of modern technology are included in the definition?
Sure. So I feel like you might not like my answer very much, but I prefer to think about artificial intelligence as almost more of a concept or a label or an idea that shifts over time. And so what we consider AI today is very different to what we would have considered AI 10 years ago, or what we would have considered to be AI maybe 50 years ago. And the reason why that matters is because artificial intelligence as an idea holds a huge amount of power. It's really alluring. It's really interesting. People have a big emotional response to it, whether that's they feel threatened or scared or excited about it, like you just said. And it makes technology seem much more exciting than if you say, for example, this is a decision tree. That doesn't really provoke the same kind of emotional reaction unless you're really, really, really nerdy, which most of us aren't to that extent. And so what I like to do in saying AI is this concept is to look a little bit less about what AI is or isn't concretely and say this is the end definition, but more to say, what do we think of as AI now? So right now, I think we're in this moment of huge excitement around very complex machine learning based models. So particularly things like large language models. So if you've ever used ChatGPT, this is a very classic example. So a model that is able to generate forms of text from a large database. I think this is something that's shifting. And there's like particular technologies that we might think of as being definitively in the space of AI. So that might include things like chess playing robots or things like AlphaGo, the AI program that famously plays the Chinese game Go. And there might be technologies that we think are very definitively not in the category of AI, like a pencil, for example. Everything else, though, I think a lot of these other kinds of technologies really shift depending on our cultural and our social understanding of what we think intelligence is and what role we think technologies should play in our society and how much autonomous decision-making power that they should have.
So what I'm hearing is that AI is a very fluid concept and it changes with time, it changes with advancement in technology. Can we expect pencil to be some form of AI in the future?
I wish, as someone who really hates handwriting things. I think there's something quite important about reclaiming things, maybe not necessarily as artificial intelligence, but as technology, even like things that we think of as being very low tech, like pencils. Because something I look at is the way that gender and race has shaped what we think of as being very technical and what we think of as being very low tech. So if you look at things like knitting needles, for example, this has been a really common technology used by a lot of people around the world, primarily women. And yet needlecraft, knitting, and all these practices are understood as being very low tech. So that's why a big movement around gender and computing a few decades ago in, say, the 1980s was to think about knitting as a kind of coding. So saying, actually, if you can read a knitting pattern, you can learn how to code. And this was one of the strategies they used to try and get more women into STEM subjects, and particularly the computational sciences.
Carrie, talk to me about this intersectionality of AI and feminism. You've discussed it on your podcast, The Good Robot. How does that play out from an ethics perspective?
In all sorts of ways. And so I've been working for the past few years to think about what it means to put feminist ideas and principles at the heart of AI ethics. Because too often, I think when people try to come up with feminist solutions in the tech space, feminism is only applied or thought about at the very end of the process. So maybe they've developed a product from start to finish, and then at the very last stage, they'll say, oh, is this going to affect women adversely? Will this affect queer people adversely or gender minorities adversely? And at that stage, to be honest, it's usually a bit too late. You might be able to patch on some quick fixes, but the feminist ethic is not baked into the whole process of design. And so for me, what feminist work looks like in technology is thinking beyond just this question of how do we make sure something fulfills basic legal obligations, and more towards this idea of how do we create technology that is actively pro-justice. So for me, that might look like taking principles from feminist activism like care or relationality or solidarity, and thinking about how can we make technologies that actively promote those things rather than undermining them. So if we think about social media, there's really powerful ways people have managed to use social media to drive activist campaigns, to connect with each other, to form mutual aid communities, to support each other during the pandemic, for example. But unfortunately, a lot of the integral features of platform design often promote hate and dissension. And I'm sure you've probably also experienced this, but certainly as a woman online, I find, unfortunately, the posts of mine that get the most engagement are when there's harassment or controversy. And this is a feature of these platforms which are built on a clickbait economy. And so I'm really interested in how feminism can inform the design of better tech platforms, better products, but also when it can tell us when we should be saying no to certain things, when we should be stepping back and saying, actually, a tech solution here is just not the right one.
But it also means that we need more women involved in AI development, right? Because at the end of the day, when we think of AI, there's somebody writing that code, and whoever writes that code also has their own perspective of what that AI technology may or may not do. We are already seeing some harmful impact or effects of AI. Like, we've heard about deep fake pictures of women, celebrities. Given the fact that there isn't a governing body or there aren't set standards for AI still, and every AI startup or company is coming up with their own standards of what AI should and shouldn't do, how does this idea of protecting certain gender identities or minorities play into this broader conversation around ethics of AI?
I mean, I think the lack of central regulation or a shared set of principles has been a major barrier in thinking about feminist approaches to AI and protecting gendered rights. So one thing that I think has come out, for example, of the EU AI Act is that a risk-based approach doesn't necessarily protect the rights of people who are subject to AI. And we've seen distinctly gendered manifestations of this when it comes to how women might be discriminated against in the use of AI-powered hiring tools, through to, as you've put, the kinds of gendered harms that emerge from tools like generative AI in the case of things like deepfakes, which again, maybe these tools weren't made specifically in order to create pornographic images and revenge porn materials, but that is how they tend to be used. And so I think while we, you know, still need to push very, very hard for these forms of generalized regulation, I think there's also still a place that civil society can play in this conversation, and that people within companies and organizations can play. So yeah, so I think an important part for civil society to play is in helping us understand and address the root causes behind why platforms create and entrench forms of gender-based harm. So if we think about deepfakes, for example, it can be helpful to think about tech solutions. So, you know, how do we ensure that these products can't be manipulated so much? But we also need to understand more broadly, you know, why do people create harmful and pornographic material in the first place? Why do we have this societal tolerance for this kind of harm? And what can be done to stop it?
But to your point, Carrie, when we think about the why in all of this, right, it's almost impossible to control human behavior. How that why manifests in harming somebody else is what we can probably control.
I agree with you that to some extent, I don't think that we can ask, say, tech companies to solve the problem of people's bad behavior. I completely agree with you on that. At the same time, I do think, though, that most of the solely tech or platform architecture solutions that we see will be doomed to fail or will really struggle to fully grapple with this kind of behavior without a better understanding of the sociological or political conditions and factors that drive this kind of behavior.
So give me an example of what would that look like?
So I think on a really basic infrastructural level, it might look like something as simple as investing in having ethical AI teams who understand local contexts and languages. So one thing that we see on platforms like Meta, for example, is we see hate speech directed against particular communities being leveraged because content moderators either A, don't have an understanding of local languages. So take, for example, in Ethiopia, where there was a genocide against Tigrayan people. And that was in part because Meta only had content moderation in four languages. And there's over 80 languages spoken in Ethiopia. This is a consistent problem across many places in the global south, where there just isn't that investment. But the second reason why I think this is important is because what hate speech means and what it looks like in different contexts is really going to vary. And people are often always shifting and changing in the kind of hateful language they use. And understanding exactly what hateful speech means in context requires a really deep understanding of particular communities and the language that they use. And so, again, a well-meaning content moderator who doesn't have that understanding might let a lot of things slip through the net without that wider understanding.
Why are you optimistic that it may happen within the AI space?
To be clear, I don't know if I am optimistic that will happen in the AI space. I hope that it will happen in the AI space, but I only think it will happen with really concerted effort by civil society and by regulators and by all of us who engage with these platforms to say that we only think that you should be globalizing with these platforms and expanding this influence with these ethical principles put at the forefront. And I think several years ago, there was a really successful concerted push around facial recognition to do with this. I think particularly in 2020, after the murder of George Floyd, people were really, really angry. And their response in part was to condemn the use of facial recognition by police departments in the US. Unfortunately, I think a lot of that critical energy did dissipate a bit around the release of ChatGPT and other large language models, because people were understandably very excited by the technological developments that were being made. But what that unfortunately meant is I think that set us back a little bit, maybe a year or two, when it came to people's critical consciousness about how much power these companies hold and the harms that their products can enact. And so what I'm hoping to see over the next year or two is the revival of a lot of that critical energy, not to say necessarily that we think these tools are inherently or entirely bad, but to say that there are really substantial harms that can and do come from them, and that those harms are really differentially experienced. And it's often women, and particularly women of color, who tend to disproportionately get harmed by them.
So let's talk about ChatGPT, because that's something that a lot of people probably are using already. What's fascinating to me with ChatGPT, and I do use it quite often, I must admit, it's so easy to use. It's so interactive, and all the information is synthesized in one place. So for me as a podcaster, if I am researching about a guest, or if I want to synthesize my thoughts in a particular way, I go on ChatGPT, it does it for me. I feel like ChatGPT is this friend that I have now. But that's scary as well, because my comfort with ChatGPT just blindsides me about the harmful impact that ChatGPT may have. What are some of the things we should be aware of as we use this technology and are becoming more comfortable in using it?
First, I do want to say that I think your experience is very normal. I think a lot of people really enjoy using ChatGPT, and they find it very relational and quite social in a way, which itself is very interesting. And anecdotally, I hear people using ChatGPT sometimes for information, how you're using it, but sometimes very directly in response to loneliness or to meet a kind of social need. And so as a sociologist or as someone who is in AI research, I find that very interesting. At the same time, there are risks that we need to think about. So I think what I'd like people to be cognizant of when they use these large language models would first be that, again, these models are trained on very, very large word databases, which largely have been scraped from the internet. And that raises several problems. And the first is that often those have not been scraped consensually. So there are a lot of writers and artists who are really upset because their books or things they've worked really, really hard on have been taken and used to train these models, and they don't benefit from that at all. So that's one major issue. The second is, unfortunately, the internet can be a very uplifting place if you're someone like me who gets a lot of cat and dog videos. And it can also be a really awful place. It can be a place where there's a huge amount of racist and sexist rhetoric online. And so, unfortunately, the large language models that we have are picking up and learning a lot of those stereotypes and biases. And again, the developers of these tools have been working, I'm sure, very, very hard to try and remove those kinds of ideas and stereotypes and words from these tools. But at the same time, ultimately, the place that these tools are starting from is from our very unequal world. And so they are going to reflect those inequalities. The third thing I would say in terms of data sets is not just thinking about what's included, like, for example, explicitly racist words, but also thinking about what's excluded. So in the UK, for example, the second most widely spoken language is a dialect spoken by Kashmiri people that has no written language form. Or also think about things like sign language, for example. These are languages that don't necessarily come in a conventional written format. And so they're not going to be used to train large language models. And so these are people who are just probably not going to benefit very much from the production of these tools. So there's kinds of structural inequality in who even gets represented in these particular data sets. And that's not even starting to grapple within the huge number of languages around the world and how the vast majority of our large language models are in English. And there's people doing cool work around this. So Masakana is a grassroots organization that aims to bring some of the thousands of African languages into natural language processing data sets. But there's still, you know, a really big gap here. There's a long way to go.
You know, you mentioned developers, and I keep going back to that because I always think, how do developers' biases manifest into this, right? Because they are creating these large language models, and then obviously these language models learn based on that foundational information. I have seen some batshit crazy developers on Twitter within this space, and I'm like, oh my gosh, these are the people who are creating these models. How does that work?
This is a great question. And I spent a couple of years talking to engineers and software developers at a big tech company from around 2020 to 2021. And of course, I think like the people you see on Twitter or on X, there are some software developers who have views about technology, which I fundamentally disagree with. I think that they might be misguided or extremely weird. However, I do think the vast majority of developers sit in a middle space where they're not necessarily trying to use their technology to challenge structural inequality, nor are they trying to use it because they think they're going to be able to upload their brain onto a computer. Instead, they sit in the middle where they don't want to actively do harm with their work, but they don't necessarily see themselves as part of the problem when it comes to creating technologies that are biased, or they just might not have ever thought about these issues. So, actually, they do care about things like sexism and racism. They want the world to be more equally distributed. They want the workplaces to be as inclusive as possible. But they also just might not necessarily see their workplace as unequal or exclusive. They might not see the technologies they're making as exclusive or problematic in some way. And a lot of that is because they don't either have the training or the experiences to identify those problems. And that's why I do think diversity really matters when it comes to product teams and who's creating these products. I'm always a little bit wary about how I put this because I don't want it to seem like anyone who comes from like a marginalized background is therefore then responsible for making a product ethical. I think that's unfortunately how this can end up playing out, which is very unfair. And I'm sure we've all experienced this in our workplaces where you become the sort of figurehead for talking about issues related to DEI, which is not your job role. But at the same time, I've seen a lot of really tangible examples where having someone on a team who has experienced something has then directly shaped the product outcome. And it's been one of the most effective ways of ensuring that a product isn't going to be harmful.
Is there any such thing as a good argument anymore? One with sharp perspectives, fair and tough questions, that leaves you free to come to your own conclusions? Thoughtful discussion is missing almost everywhere in our lives. But you'll find it on Hear Me Out, Slate's new podcast. I'm your host, Celeste Headlee. Each week, we'll talk, We'll listen and we'll ask the hard questions on issues that matter. Every Tuesday on Slate's Hear Me Out with Celeste Headlee. Join us.
Can you imagine a world where job description for software developers would somehow embody their ethical stance?
I love this idea. I wish we would see something along these lines. I would love to see more of a reflective practice when it comes to understanding engineers' approach to technology, what they think technology should be for, how they see their own identities. And I do think, broadly speaking, when we say are looking at race and whiteness, I think a lot of maybe white engineers and computer scientists have never really had to think of themselves as white by the function of the white majority societies they've grown up in. And so what that ends up meaning is that they don't necessarily have that reflexive muscle built up to say, okay, well, actually, what am I missing as someone who has maybe never experienced racism? Like, who do I need to be talking to? Who do I need to be including in this conversation? And so that's something I would love to see being built up. Maybe that's in job descriptions, but maybe it's something as simple as actually wider teams have these commitments to saying, have we thought reflectively about who's on our team and who's not on our team?
When I think about this, I also think about how this can be modeled around the globe, right? Because in the US specifically, there is so much focus on race, racial hierarchy. So yes, for US, it will be centered around the concept of racism, the concept of equality, racial justice. But then it will manifest in different ways in different countries, right? Because a lot of countries struggle with other issues. So the concept and the conversations around ethics will also change as we move from one country to another.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something that really worries me about these tools is that they're designed to be applied at scale. So the allure of them is you can buy the software package and that was made in one country, and usually that's the US, and you can apply it somewhere in Europe. And I think that's quite dangerous because, as you've pointed out, the local conditions are very, very different. And so even if we take the idea specifically of race, which, as you've quite rightly identified as really central to when we're thinking about structures of inequality in the US, the US has such a distinct idea of race, such distinct racial categories that don't make sense anywhere else in the world.
Anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, literally nowhere else. I'm from Aotearoa, New Zealand, and our racial categories and ideas of race are really fundamentally different to the US. And so if you try to apply a tool in New Zealand from the US, and the US provider says, oh, this tool has been tested. It doesn't contain racial bias. It's going to treat everyone equally. To that, I would say, well, who are you treating equally? Because if you've tested on a US-based database, then you might be testing on categories that actually just don't pertain to this new context at all. And that, like you said, then let alone when it comes to other kinds of categorizations like caste, for example, which again means something very, very different in another context, or say religious affiliation.
Yeah, so I feel like the universality of these models can be questioned, right? So somehow these models have to be grounded in local understanding of, culture, politics, identity. I don't know how that's going to happen. Again, I'm just thinking about different ideas, but something to think about. Carrie, I do want to pivot to your podcast, The Good Robot, where you talk about all the interesting stuff regarding AI. But you do ask your guests what good technology is. And often your guests say terms like good or bad are too binary because it depends on how we use technology, how it's created. We've talked about, beneficial and harmful ways that AI is used. But give me an example of some of the most problematic elements of AI that you've witnessed so far.
Oh boy, I could give you a lot of examples. This is the downside of working in AI ethics, as you see a lot of the seedy underbelly of these tools. So some of the most worrying tools I see that I think there should be a lot more public scrutiny of are things like emotion recognition technology that don't really even have a scientific basis. So this is an area of AI development which claims that people can develop algorithms that can read attributes like your emotional state from your face or from your body. And they're quite popular when it comes to security applications, but they have a wide range of different pseudoscientific applications. And I think these tools are just bad from start to finish. They're bad because they're often trained on data sets that, again, have been scraped non-consensually. So, for example, often by testing. So one of these firms, Affectiva, very famously did a lot of its product testing on autistic children. And so I would say that there's already a dynamic here where consent is not really possible in that situation. But then also all the way through to what are you even planning to use this for? Because the connections that these tools draw between, you know, certain aspects of your body language and what you're saying and your emotional state are quite spurious. They're often premised on this idea of Paul Ekman's six basic emotions, which Ekman argues are culturally consistent across the world, which again, I would question. But I think anyone who has, you know, interacted with other people knows that our facial expressions and how we talk is not always a very good indicator of how we're feeling on the inside. From anyone who's had to plaster on a fake smile in a meeting through to people who just don't laugh during movies and don't cry. Some people don't emote like that.
You're so right. This is a very dangerous path to go on, right? But I do want to end it on a positive note. I want to talk about the benefits and the good side of AI. Do you have any examples of that?
Yes, I think that to me, I like to think about AI through the lens of conscious consumption, in the same way that we think about other kinds of materials like plastic, for example. So the reason why I like plastic as a metaphor or a comparison is because even though we know there are huge costs with plastic, such as environmental damage, it's also been an incredibly important and transformative part of our lives. It's really made the way we live so much easier. And that doesn't mean that I don't think we should be grappling with the environmental damage of plastic, but that it still is very important in a lot of contexts. And so I guess this is what I also think of when it comes to good uses of AI, where a lot of people I talk to find ChatGPT, for example, really, really helpful for them, maybe because English is their second language, or because they struggle to process large amounts of information. And it's something that brings a tangible benefit to their lives. I personally use AI transcription software and things like Dragon, for example, which is a voice recognition and transcription tool, because I love to be able to voice dictate my research and my essays rather than having to type them out by hand. It fits so much better for how I think. And I feel very lucky to have access to these kinds of tools because a lot of people don't have access to them. And so that's why it's important to me to not completely come down on the side of all tech development is bad or all AI is ultimately harmful. I think we need to be balancing that against these broader questions of actually, can our planet sustain creating these tools? How are these tools shared? Are they shared very inequitably? But at the same time, I'm really inspired by Maya Ganesh, who is a researcher here, who also talks about finding joy in technology and how one aspect of feminist activism and practice can be hacking and playing with technology and using it in really imaginative ways. And I think we continue to see that both online and offline when it comes to how we use tech, especially AI.
You do this fun segment on TikTok where you discuss and rate AI characters on screen based on AI ethics.
Today, we are talking about Ultron from the Avengers franchise. Ultron's the big bad in the second Avengers film, which is terrible. So if you haven't seen it, don't bother. But I'm going to tell you why, as an AI ethicist, I do not think that Ultron would pass an AI ethics assessment. So first, Ultron tries to eradicate all of humanity. Very classic science fiction trope, not very good from an AI ethics standpoint.
And we've talked about AI ethics throughout this conversation. And I wonder, what are the standards in an AI ethics test that you use?
Yes, so this series on TikTok is a little bit tongue-in-cheek. So I use some of these very classic principles that people used to use in AI ethics assessments. So things like fairness, explainability. So how well can we know how a system has come to a particular decision? Trustworthiness. These principles have been critiqued quite a lot. on the basis that they're often quite high level and it can be a little bit hard to understand what they mean in context. But one of the reasons why I quite like to apply these principles to science fiction characters is because I just think it's quite funny. Like, obviously, if you have the Terminator kind of coming out to eradicate people, you might say, okay, well, I think this probably, you know, isn't going to pass most of these tests. But yes, I mean, something I do think is really helpful, though, is in recent years, we've seen these broad standards be contextualized and nuanced a bit by critical voices. So, for example, people have asked questions like, you know, what does it mean for a system to not just be technically fair in that it weights groups equally or it treats different groups or within data equally? And what would it mean actually for a tool to be like politically fair or socially fair? So to be responsive to the inequalities that already exist in our world. And so I think those kinds of questions are really good. But in the meantime, you know, I'll continue to rate these sci-fi characters in film.
What is your favorite AI character in terms of ethics standards?
Ooh, that's a good one. So I'm trying to pick ones that people will have seen rather than like very niche characters that I personally love from, say, like a science fiction book that maybe only I have read. I love Baymax from Big Hero 6. For those who haven't seen this, it's an animated film with this huge kind of inflatable health robot.
Morning, Baymax. Baymax?
Hello, kitty kitty. I am Baymax. My apologies. Please enjoy your ramen.
And I think what's quite lovely about this robot is that it's very, very gentle. It's trying to show how we can coexist peacefully between humans and technology rather than falling into this very classic dominance and submission narrative we see in a lot of like Western sci-fi in particular. The only points I would really dock from Baymax is in general, I think there's a push to try to not design robots so that they look like anthropomorphic or humanoids for Baymax. But aside from that, you know, I think there's a lot of things about this story, which is really quite lovely.
Any characters from Black Mirror?
Oh, goodness. I find Black Mirror to be often depressingly too close to my work. But there is an episode which is really similar to what some of my colleagues research around digital death and digital immortality. So there's an episode from a very early season where one of the characters gets reincarnated based on their social media profile.
So, how am I sounding? Hello?
Hello. You sound just like him.
Almost creepy, isn't it? I say creepy, I mean it's totally batshit crazy I can even talk to you. I mean, I don't even have a mouth.
That's just...
Just what?
It's just the sort of thing that he would say.
Well, that's why I said it.
And this is a service that increasingly is becoming either it's happening or it's becoming very likely. And so a team of researchers here at the Leverhulme Center are thinking about what are the ethics of these digital reincarnation programs? Do we think that they're a good thing? What regulations do we need to put in place? And they're trying to think about that interculturally, because also how we think about death is really, really different cross-culturally. So I think that's a particular Black Mirror episode that really interests me, but also feels a little bit too close to home.
Oh my gosh, that sounds so scary, Kerry. We could have another episode on just that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting ethical minefield.
In the end, Kerry, if you were to describe the United States of America in the context of AI advancement, how would you do that?
I think the biggest hope for change comes from below, and that I think civil society is doing and has so much it can do to try and rein Silicon Valley back in. Because I think so much of what I see in like US tech development is this like really old fashioned colonialist, like frontier mindset. It's like move fast and break things. We can make things happen. And I'm really inspired by this generation of activists I see who are trying to hold big tech to account and saying, we're not going to accept that. And so Yeah, I think when it comes to AI, like, I'm most hopeful when it comes to how people are organizing and response to and in resistance to these companies.
Thank you, Kerry. This was so good. Where can people find more information about your work and your podcast?
Well, the Good Robot Podcast, which I run with Dr. Eleanor Drage, is available on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, wherever else you get your podcasts. And we also have a new book out called The Good Robot, which is based on the podcast, which you can buy online from Waterstones, Amazon. And it also is fully illustrated. It's a collection of these beautiful little essays by guests on our podcast, all responding to the prompt of good technology is dot, dot, dot. So it might be good technology is free or good technology challenges power. And so if this is something you're interested in and you want something to read that you can dip in and out of, that's something to just spark your mind a little bit before bed or in the morning, I would highly recommend picking it up.
Thank you, Kerry. This was wonderful. I'm so glad we were able to sit down and have this conversation virtually because of technology.
Thank you so much for having me.
This was so much fun. Look, as I said, I am a closeted geek. I enjoy using technology. I like to learn about technology in a different life. I would probably be part of creating technology, writing codes. I don't know. I've always been fascinated by it. So this was a fun conversation personally because I got to talk about something that I really enjoy and don't understand as much, so was curious to know more. I hope you liked this conversation. I wonder how you use ChatGPT in your everyday life, or do you even use it? Write to me if you have any thoughts. You can always reach me at sadhya@immigrantlypod.com. This episode was produced by me, written by Michaela Strather and me. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Hazik Ahmed Farid. The theme music for this podcast is done by Simon Hutchinson. Don't forget to follow us on socials. We are everywhere. Come back next week when we have another fun conversation. Take care and use technology sensibly.